Welcome to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. This week, we're going to get some great tips for summer travel safety. We're going to get the update from the State Director of AARP Pennsylvania on nursing homes. We'll also hear from the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Alzheimer's Association on the new Alzheimer's drug that was approved this week. Starting us off this week on Special Edition, June is Pride Month. And from Devereaux Pocono, Clinical Director Michelle Wonders tells us how they are supporting the LGBT community.
Thank you for having me again today, Paul. It's very wonderful to be back with you. So, again, my name is Dr. Michelle Wonders. I'm the clinical director at Devereaux Advanced Behavioral Health, located in the Poconos. And at Devereaux, we provide behavioral health care to a variety of individuals. We are a national nonprofit organization from California to Florida to Massachusetts to everywhere, New York. And in Pennsylvania, we have a large number of individuals we serve because in Pennsylvania is where Devereaux originated in the Philadelphia area. Miss Helena Devereaux actually realized that some students learn differently, and she started caring for children who had special learning needs, and really the organization has just blossomed from there since 1912.
So. And that's been around a long time, and there have been a lot of changes then. And Devereaux keeps up with everything that's happening.
We do. We pride ourselves on being thought leaders in the field of behavioral health care. We like to be on the leading edge of any new initiatives, staying on top of issues of multiculturalism and inclusion, which hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about today, and just the evidence-based practices that Devereaux is known for.
Well, that was why when I got your email to talk about Devereaux today, especially the focus that Devereaux has during Pride Month. Where does that fit in, Michelle?
Well, it fits in everywhere is the short answer to that. But of course, I'll expand upon that some more.
I hope so.
Devereaux has really taken the lead and taken an initiative on being committed to providing culturally competent care to the individuals that we serve and their families. So when you think about a family coming for services or even a couple applying for foster care to become foster care parents, that family can look very different depending on the individual makeup there. So we celebrate diversity. We celebrate Pride Month, which of course is focused on LGBTQ plus individuals, both in employment opportunities as well as our individuals that we serve. So some of the things that we do there, we really are trying to be the most inclusive behavioral health care organization in the country. So that's a very high bar, but we have multiple efforts going on at the same time to really work towards those goals. One is that we have had more recent creation of a diversity, inclusion, and equity group, which is a national work group, and that kind of has been rolled out to all of our Devereaux centers across the nation. So that involves training for our staff, really ensuring that our programs and our facilities are seen as a safe space for anybody coming in who may be of any diversity.
And I guess that's something that I just didn't think, although it would have a direct correlation with everything that you're involved in, because you were also telling us that you're looking for foster families. And
we are.
People hadn't thought about that there's a tie in there.
Right. Again, family is a word that means a lot of different things to different people. And it really could mean a same-sex couple that is interested in fostering or adopting a child. And it also, you know, goes into our staff, where our staff that come and work here, we want them to feel that they can express their authentic gender self and how, and that they can express who they are without fear of any repercussion or any kind of backlash for that. You know, we really want people to feel safe and secure that, you know, regardless of their gender identity or their sexual orientation, that we welcome all people to Devereaux across the whole organization.
And along the same lines then, in dealing with those who are utilizing your facilities as well, because again, you have a lot of young people who are involved in Devereaux.
And, you know, we really have adopted what the American Psychological Association calls the gender affirmative model. And this really is seen as the emerging best practice of choice for transgender, gender expansive youth, adults, and it really focuses on issues of resilience, coping, and wellness. So we adopted this model in 2019, and we really have reviewed all of our policies and procedures to be sure that they support that model. We have what we call a gender support plan. So that really helps our clinicians in working with the individuals, whether they're adults in an outpatient setting or children in a group home setting, how to best support them in those settings based on, you know, their gender diversity. We really want everybody feel welcome and safe when they walk through our doors. And that's a quote from our chief medical officer.
Again, you mentioned in the very beginning of our interview today that Devereaux has been around since
1912.
So a lot of things changed since 1912. And that being the entire idea of Pride Month, for example, that wasn't around in 1912.
Pride Month actually has come about since there's an uprising in Stonewall in New York City in actually this month in June of 1969. So that is really what we recognize when we think about Pride Month, to really celebrate the diversity and really supporting people's ability and God-given right to express their sexuality and gender identity. I've been with Devereaux in May. It was 30 years for me.
Wow.
So, May 21st was 30 years since my first day at Devereaux when I was a teenager now. And so I really do appreciate you letting me come on and speak about what I do, which is work with Devereaux, and I love doing that.
Well, again, that brings me back to, never mind 1912, there's been a lot of changes in 30 years, and I'm sure that during the time that you were there, as I said, Pride Month did not exist 30 years ago. The whole idea of the LGBTQ community being out, involved, talked about, that was also something that did not happen 30 years ago. So
Exactly. That
must be a very rewarding feeling, being in the stream of all that and seeing how the progression has gone from when you first started to what you're doing today.
Yeah, definitely. And things, of course, have changed drastically over these 30 years. And it's been really a privilege for me to be working with Devereaux and to just be fortunate enough to work with an organization who really embraces the diversity we always have, but really looking for ways to up our game with that all the time. We are always looking for those opportunities, and this has really been a great initiative. We're having some really frank and open conversations internally with these groups that Maxine is doing with us, and really just keeping that conversation going, because we have to talk about these issues in order to the utmost inclusivity for our individuals and our staff. So this June, this year, is the 51st anniversary of the first Pride Parade, which occurred in 1970, which interestingly enough was the year I was born. But that was 1 year after the uprising at the Stonewall Inn. And I would imagine that the first Pride Parade was nothing like the magnitude that we see today. But a lot of people don't realize that it has been happening for 51 years this year.
Right. And again, it's the changes, and it's how the changes have been embraced by so many different organizations in so many different ways. And yours is just an example of one of those.
Thank you.
That's why I guess when I first saw the email, I thought, oh, okay, Pride Month. And then it took a few moments to kick in that, yes, of course that would be involved. But like the people back in 1912, I just don't expect things to change that fast, I guess, or that everybody catches up with everything so fast. But in Devereaux's case, you certainly have been able to do all that and more.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And we believe it's really important just to make sure that we are following all of our best practices as an organization, that we're working to develop a certification process for our clinicians and for our different Devereux centers, just to be sure that we are all delivering informed care, competent care under that gender affirmative model, and really just to give the individuals and families that we work with that vote of confidence that they're going to be treated fairly, that we will treat everybody with dignity and respect, which is definitely part of our core beliefs. Really, you know, making sure that we're all following the same, we're all marching to the same drum.
You're not only doing it for your clients, but you mentioned the fact that you're doing it in the workplace as well. How are you doing that?
Well, as I mentioned, we recently have this really, really nice initiative. It's called our DEI initiative. So it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. And at every Devereux location, we have champions of that. Right now, they're undertaking a huge project of speaking with all of the different groups, teams, and things like that about their views about how Devereux works with diversity and LGBTQ and all forms of diversity. Surveying staff about, you know, if they feel safe in the workplace. So we're really trying to get to all of the information we need to make the best decisions to increase our competence. So this is all part of this certification process that we're going to be developing and rolling out.
It just fascinates me that everybody gets on the page in one area, and then there are so many other areas where people don't get on the page, but you're bringing all of the areas together, and that's great. Let's talk a little bit about your foster parent program. You're still looking?
We are. We are always looking for compassionate, caring families or individuals who would be willing to open their home to either a child or an adult that they might want to foster. We have opportunities for adult foster care as well as children's foster care. It takes a special person, but I can tell you right now, there are a lot of special people out there who have already opened their homes and their heart to someone who needs a stable home. It's really wonderful to work with these families who have individuals living with them.
What do you require of the families?
Some basics that we require of families. They do go through a background check. We provide extensive training and support as they go through the whole process. We look at issues of safety. We make sure that they have everything they need to set them up for success.
And then as far as moving on into maybe interviewing them, is that the next step in the process?
Yes. So I could walk you through the whole process a little bit.
Great. Let's do that.
So what a family could do if they were interested in exploring this opportunity is to give Maxine Torres, who's our wonderful recruiter, a call. And you could call her at 272-228-0374. We'll put a little phone number in there for you. So they would call and speak with Maxine. She would do give some information over the phone and speak with them, collect some information, and then we would send out an application package for them to complete. Just some basic information. It's nothing overly laborious. So we get the application back and review it, and then we would give the person a call, go out and meet them. We follow all COVID protocols for sanitation, mask wearing, social distancing, all of those things. So go out and meet the family, meet the person who was the contact person, and just get a sense for you know, who they are. Because one of the big pieces of this whole process is matching the child or adult with a really good family that is a good match. So we really work hard to really talk with them about what their preferences are, what their wishes are, and also the child, what kind of family they would like to be placed with, and really try to do a very thorough matching process, which really helps maximize success with the placement. So we do look at the physical aspects of the home, making sure it meets any, you know, regulatory requirements that we have, that, you know, there's handrails and things like that. We look at, you know, making sure there's no safety concerns. We have a pretty thorough, you know, vetting process for that to make sure that, again, everybody is set up for success. And then we move into our training phase where we're providing training on everything from CPR and first aid to specific issues that they may encounter with children with mental health topics. We provide training on, you know, mood disorders or autism or attention deficit disorder or whatever it is they might be encountering in some of these children that they would work with.
Someone's interested, they go through all that, they are cleared, and then How do you make the connection with someone?
We receive referrals from various places. We might receive a referral from the county mental health developmental services organization, or we might receive a referral from the like a children and youth worker. So we, for our adults, we might receive it through the county supports coordinator. So so we would get a referral. We look at that internally as well. And then we gather as much information as we can so that when we think we have a good match, we can present the information to the potential foster family and explain what's going on with this individual and, you know, see if we can get a match there. But all of it is done very, very thoughtfully, and we put a lot of thought into who we place with various families to make sure that they have the right training, they have all the information they need to be successful.
And once that placement is made, is there a length of time, or how do you go about following up to find out whether it is actually a good match?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So for our children's foster care program, it is more of a therapeutic foster care model. So we are very, our therapists and our behavior specialists and our coordinator are very involved. They're making visits a couple times a week out to the home, providing therapy, providing family therapy. And the goal with the program is ultimately to reunify the child with either their family or a more permanent resource, whether that be an extended family member or an adoption situation or a more permanent foster care placement. So while we're working with the child, we're working with those other systems to make those connections. So it is pretty intensive, and we are definitely there supporting every step of the way.
And as well it should be, because again, that's a very difficult thing to, first of all, open up your front door to someone, and second of all, be responsible for someone.
Yes.
So you want to make sure that everybody is in the right place.
Exactly.
So once again, give us the information as far as if anyone would like to contact you regarding that or regarding the support that Devereaux and their model of care gives to the LGBTQ community and how people can find out more about that.
Sure. Actually, Maxine Torres, who is our recruiter for our program, is also our champion for our diversity efforts. So if you wanted to talk to her about both of those things, she's the person to speak with. So her number is 272-228-0374. Again, that's Maxine Torres. She is our recruiter, and she's just a wonderful person to talk with. So if you ever just want to have a nice conversation about foster care and what that's about or about our diversity efforts, she's wonderful.
Always a pleasure to speak with Dr. Michelle Wonders, Clinical Director of Devereaux Pocono. And just a reminder, you can find out more about Devereaux and their LGBT community commitment by going to their website, Devereaux.org. And there's also plenty of information there about becoming a foster parent. Next here on Special Edition, we'll hear from Clay Jacobs, the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Alzheimer's Association, and the new Alzheimer's drug that was approved this week. Welcome back to Special Edition. Earlier this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a new medication that cannot cure Alzheimer's disease, but one treatment may delay the clinical decline. When word of the new drug being released was announced, Odyssey's Frank Andrews got on the line with those on the front line of Alzheimer's disease here in Pennsylvania.
On the line with us right now is Clay Jacobs. He is the executive director of the Greater Pennsylvania Alzheimer's Association. Clay, thank you so much for joining us. How are you, sir?
I'm good today, sir. Thank you for having us and for this important discussion. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Your office was so quick to respond, and I'm grateful for that. So what's your initial response reaction to this news about the new Alzheimer's drug?
Yeah, so at the Alzheimer's Association, on behalf of those impacted by Alzheimer's, and really, we welcome and celebrate today's, what is a historic FDA approval, because it's a new day for millions of Americans. This is the first drug, per the FDA approvals, that's shown to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And so this is the beginning not the end, but just the beginning of what is a new future, hopefully, for Alzheimer's treatments overall as well.
Now, you know, one of the things that's in the headline just is striking, and that is FDA approves first new Alzheimer's drug in almost 20 years. Is the disease that mysterious that it, that 20 years not able to find another drug?
Absolutely. When we think about the complexity of our brain and the ability to look at it, that's the starting point. How do we do that? How do we make sure that we're testing the right thing? Alzheimer's disease is just one form of dementia. And so even for portions of that time, our ability to look at the brain and the impact medications or other therapeutics was having were really limited. We're looking at symptoms. We're trying to catch up to things. And so we've seen things like imaging and accurate diagnosis improve. There's still room to grow, but it's helped us put a more focused effort. And then ultimately, through organizations, including our own, that have advocated, we've seen places like the National Institute on Health increase Alzheimer's disease research funding, which had been stagnant since the 80s, has increased sevenfold in the past 10 years. And so all of a sudden, we're in an environment where we've just had more shots on goal and an increased understanding. And it's those types of things that lead to the exciting news like today, but even what we hope to be more exciting news in the years ahead about other treatments and other interventions.
Clay, Pennsylvania, the statistics in Pennsylvania, are we pretty much on the national average? Do we see more Alzheimer's, fewer Alzheimer's cases? What's the situation?
So it does ebb and flow comparatively, but as you'd imagine, age is the biggest risk factor. And so with Pennsylvania's aging population in 2020, there are 280,000 people just living with a diagnosis, never mind the caregivers and friends and families and care partners. But even in Pennsylvania, because of our aging population, that number is expected to increase from 280,000 in 2020 to 320,000 in just by 2025. And so certainly, comparatively, it's impactful. Even just in the Commonwealth, we know the numbers are staggering and the impact is even greater.
Now, you mentioned aging, but do we know what causes it, or are there factors that contribute to it?
We know the hallmarks of the disease, right? We know what to look for. In fact, today's discussion looks at, or today's decision really looks at a medication that's able to clear amyloid, which is one of the hallmarks of the disease. But even so, we know things that are really about not prevention, but protection and risk reduction. We know things that are good for our heart, social activity, mental activity, diet, exercise, all reduce risk. What we know, and we just mentioned some of the research that's going, we're at a point where actually the largest ever lifestyle risk reduction trial called the U.S. Pointer Study is going on right now in sites throughout the U.S. And so we know on small scale studies, but really the work going on right now is what are the things that we know are evidence-based that impact everyone that we can recommend to reduce risk? And so things like therapeutics and risk reduction and earlier diagnosis through screening and biomarkers, all of this combined is what it will take to be able to stem the tide of impact that this disease has on too many.
Now, I immediately went to your website, and the first thing that jumps out there is June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, the perfect time to join the fight. So what do you want people to do, or what can we do?
This disease impacts communities day in and day out, whether it's where you work or live or pray or play. And so it takes that type of engagement to make a difference. We want people to understand that this is not a normal part of aging, to talk to their friends, to talk to their families, to share with others. This is a disease that so often is isolating, but it doesn't need to be for us to be proactive. And so we hope people decide to reach out, that they reach out to us and become involved in policy or programs or some of our fundraising events. There are things to do if you want to make a difference. All it takes is reaching out that hand the first time.
This question has come in about 7 or 8 times, and that is your organization a resource for finding services, finding physicians, finding anything that we need to help a family member?
Absolutely. So from education programs, support groups, referrals, care planning sessions, we are available 24/7. Folks can visit our website, they can find out about programmings, or we even have a 24/7 helpline that's available in 200 languages and dialects at 800-272-3900. Whether it's a question about something they heard during our time together today or an in-depth care issue, there's always someone available to help talk with you and your family.
Wow. Now, in just a minute, I'm going to ask you to give people contact information again. When will this new medicine be available, and should I be calling my doctor today?
So it certainly is. Approval is the first stage. There's a whole slew of things about bringing it to market. I would say there's certainly, if folks have questions, we encourage them to talk to their healthcare providers now to learn more about this treatment. I think what's really important for the association as we look ahead is that our highest priority is eliminating barriers to access now that it's available. And our focus will be doing everything in our power to ensure access to not only the drug, but also any diagnostic test needed during the treatment process for all those who benefit. We think there's a pathway there. Infusion therapies like this have been used and have been made available under Medicare and insurance for cancer and multiple sclerosis and others. So it's reasonable to hope that it's also true for this. And so as it rolls out, as the company and others start to determine those things, we're going to be advocating for people and for access at every step of the way.
One more time, give people information on how they can reach your website and the phone number.
Absolutely. So alz.org/PA. Or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can reach us at 800-272-3900.
Clay, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again if we need information, because you're a wealth of information.
Thanks once again to Odyssey's Frank Andrews and Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Alzheimer's Association. Since the beginning of the pandemic, AARP Pennsylvania has been keeping a close eye on how the elderly across the state are being taken care of. Bill Johnston Walsh, State Director of AARP Pennsylvania, is here to tell us about the state of nursing homes across the Commonwealth. The folks at AARP have been doing all kinds of great things to keep everyone informed, updated, and safe. And now we're talking about nursing home residents. So what does AARP have going on in that area?
Well, thank you, Paula. AARP has really been pushing, working with Governor Wolf and his administration to make sure that, you know, nursing homes have the protections that they need and that the residents and staff get the vaccine. Over 50% of the COVID deaths that happened in Pennsylvania occurred in nursing facilities. And to put it into more perspective, out of the almost 26,000 individuals that died of COVID-19 here in Pennsylvania, a little over 500 were under the age of 49. So that means the other, 25,000 were over the age of 50. So we have to just make sure that those individuals are protected as we move forward. I have to give credit to Governor Wolf and his team. We've come a long way since January. It was a little bumpy in the beginning, as you know, Paula. Mm-hmm. But I think we're in a better place overall. I can tell you with residents of facilities, there's probably about 80 to 85% that are now vaccinated. Where the problem is with the staff. Right now, less than 50% of nursing home staff are vaccinated. And that is a big issue, for the safety of the residents and of the staff in the administration at these facilities.
And what do you suppose you can give that to? Is it the fact that because I was just going to ask you, the vaccines are becoming more and more available. So is that part of the reason, or are there others?
No, I think the availability has never been an issue because the nursing homes were targeted right from the very beginning. They were in phase 1A. So that wasn't an issue. The hesitancy comes, I think, from misinformation, people hearing things from their colleagues or hearing things from family members, reading stuff on the internet, which is always a no-no, with just hearing all of the stuff that goes on there. Worried that, they've been hearing stories about the side effects. I think that's where it was. What we've been hearing is that a lot of the staff are like, we're going to take a wait and see attitude. Let's have most of the population here in Pennsylvania get it. If no one, dies or gets really bad side effects, then maybe we'll think about doing it. So that hesitancy is really from fear, I believe, and not wanting to do it.
I think that just transverses not only from into the nursing facilities, but into a lot of the population in general, especially now that we're hearing of so much more vaccine available and they're not having anybody to give it to. So that's a little disconcerting. Exactly. Right. So let's talk about the nursing homes, because as you said, we have come a long way since January, and there are many people that are now able to visit their loved ones in nursing facilities. So what have you been hearing as far as that goes? Has all of that started to become a little better for the residents?
It has. It has. At AARP, we have 1.8 million members around the state. So we've been hearing from all of them, a lot of them, I should say, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them, getting back into the facility over the past couple of months has been hard, but they're starting to be able to go back in. We did see, and Paula, as you know, we did see, the isolation from families did not go well for a lot of these residents. You know, we've seen significant health declines in individuals that were not able to keep in touch with their family and friends. But we are seeing that now. It's at different levels in different institutions, even though the federal government and the state have said that, yes, visitation can start again. Some nursing homes are saying that the only way you can come in, obviously, is if you can prove that you've had the vaccine, which is, we don't have a problem with. But they also are putting time limits. They're like, okay, well, you have to tell us, when you're coming in, make an appointment to see your loved one. And then they're saying that that it can only be for half an hour. And people that have not seen, like grandchildren, have not seen their grandparents, or children have not seen their parents in months, over a year. This is really a heart-wrenching, that they can only go in once a week for a half an hour or less. So we're working with the nursing home industry, really asking them to expand this, to be able to say, okay, what type of visitation, is it still, are some nursing homes, facilities having people come into the facility, or are there still people that have to stay outside or distant, and not be able to give a loved one the hugs that they so need. So it's still a little sad to see that. And we're hoping that, as the vaccines get more and more into the community, that they're going to be loosening these restrictions.
So if you have a loved one in a nursing home, then, or any type of long-term care facility, should you ask certain questions, or are there certain questions that you should be asking in order to find out? I mean, if you want to go visit someone, obviously the first question is, when can I come in? But above and beyond that, are there things that people should be asking?
I'm glad you asked that question, Paula, because at AARP, we've been thinking about that as well. And we've been hearing from the 65 plus population and their families, we've been putting together a checklist of 8 questions that you should really be asking, a facility. And those are for people that have loved ones in a facility, or you're thinking about putting a loved one in a facility. And the questions range from, how far along are you with the COVID-19 vaccines? For both the residents and for staff, are you just through the first dose? Have you given the second dose? Has anyone in this facility tested positive for COVID-19 over the past 2 weeks? I think that's still important, because you still have, residents, staff, vendors coming in and out of the facility, family members. So it's key to find out what that positivity rate is, if anything. Talking about, how do you prevent outbreaks? What are the measures you have in place? And then all the way up to the staffing levels, how healthy programs are being maintained in the facility. How do you keep that connection going with all the residents so they don't feel isolated, type deal? So those are the questions that we have families can ask. It's key to be able to ask these questions, because you don't want to be able to have to put someone in a facility and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, well, I can't go visit them, or I'm very restricted in visiting them, or, oh, there's an outbreak that happened, 2 weeks later, and I didn't ask the question about, what do you have in place to make sure that this does not happen again in your facility or in nursing homes in general.
But it sounds like through our discussion here that you and AARP are feeling again much more confident about the way that things are being handled than even just the last time we talked, which was probably a little over a month ago.
Yes, things have definitely, we've been pushing the Wolf administration and the governor, has been listening. He's been listening to us. He's been listening to individuals that have been saying, we understand that we have to have all these things in place, but at the same time, you need to focus on those that have been hit hardest by this virus, and by this pandemic. And they have been listening. So we as a Commonwealth are in a much better place than we were even, as you said, Paula, a month ago.
Right.
So yes, AARP feels much better in where we're going. And again, we're trying to get the education out there. So yes, we're focused on nursing homes. We're focused on those types of facilities, personal care homes, assisted living facilities. But we're also looking at the general public as a whole and the 50 plus out there, and especially the homebound. Those are those individuals that, want to get a vaccine, but have no way to either make the appointment or get someone to come in to give them the shot within their facility or get transportation to go to a clinic to be able to have the shot.
And as far as getting more information, and not only even from AARP, you also have others that you are the ombudsmans of different facilities. Can you give our listeners some of the direction that they can go if they do need more information?
Yes, definitely. If your listeners think that, the safety and well-being of their either spouse, family member, parent, is in jeopardy or they have some questions, always reach out to the Pennsylvania Ombudsman. And that number is 717-783-8975. That's 717-783-8975. Or they can go on to the Department of Aging website at www.aging.pa.gov. The other thing is with AARP, we have a landing page that people can go to. So the 8 questions to ask, any other questions about side effects or questions about the vaccine, they can go there and get these answers. We also have a listing on our page of all the other places that they can go to get answers. And that's www.aarp.org/PAvaccines. So, if anybody has any questions, again, it's www.aarp.org/PAvaccine.
You stay safe.
Paula, thank you. Thank you so much, Paula. Yes, we're fighting the good fight out there, and we just want to make sure that, we get the word out. And I can't thank you enough for getting the word out to your listeners, Paula.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you just keep in touch with me, okay? So we know that everything's good, because when I hear your voice, I feel more positive.
Very good. Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Next on Special Edition, Summer Travel Safety. Next on Special Edition, don't forget to pack your common sense. Dawn Webster, Advanced Practice Clinician Director of MedExpress, is here to tell us. Dawn, we're going to be traveling more than ever, I think, this summer. So what are some of the common sense things we need to remember that we may have forgotten?
So everyone is excited to get back to normal. I would say, most importantly, just like you said, common sense. So if you're using public transportation, bring wipes, bring sanitizing wipes, bring hand sanitizer. If you're getting on a bus or an airplane or a train, wipe down that area before you sit down, just like you did when you had little kids. You don't even think about it. You put your arm on the armrest, you touch your face, you're eating. So it's definitely a good idea to wipe everything down. Even though they're being more diligent about cleaning before you get on, it's always a good idea to do it yourself also.
When we're talking about traveling, once again, let's start with people who are now going to be going back on airlines. And there are so many different things. And as you mentioned, bringing the wipes with you and cleaning things down. But again, when you're traveling by air, sometimes you don't have the same kind of thinking that you would if you were someplace else, because we're not used to doing that. So would there be anything special that we should remember or consider doing when we are, whether we're taking small children or not, if we're going by air?
So the first thing I would say to do is to check with the airline, because some of them have certain requirements. Some of them, I think most of them, are still requiring people, even if they're fully vaccinated against COVID, to wear a face covering. With children, most of the time it's older than two. But again, check with the airline just to make sure you have one with you. The cloth ones they make for kids, I know my kids prefer those, you know, significantly over the surgical paper masks. So it's always a good idea, especially if it's a long flight, to have one that they're more comfortable in. And then hand sanitizer is always good to have. You know, if you're traveling, it's got to be under, I think, 2 or 3 ounces. So make sure it's going to be able to go in your carry-on with you. And again, just do your best. Try to explain to kids to not touch their mouths, or to try not to hold on to the objects that other people are using, like stair railings or pushing buttons or playing with, you know, the window shades that go up and down, things like that.
And along the same lines, you're mentioning pushing buttons. So a lot of people may also be spending time in hotels, motels, condos, Airbnbs, all those kind of things for the first time since who knows when they had the opportunity to do that before. The same common sense applies. But again, when we're thinking about being out of our own environment, let's say we're in one of those, what would be one of the things that maybe we might not think about? As example, pushing those elevator buttons.
So pushing the elevator buttons, the other thing that, you know, I think would be super important to do, they have cleaning companies come in, you know, they wipe the surfaces down, but they're also, as they're going, turning on and off lights, opening and closing doors. So if possible, if you can, before your family gets in there, send someone in with the wipes, with the Lysol spray, and hit all the light switches, all the doorknobs, all the toilet flushers, all the things that you, even the sink handles, all those things that you touch and you don't even think about that, you know, may have been missed by cleaning people, or, you know, they could be cleaning and turning lights on and off as they go. So one of the things you may not think about are the light switches. When people are cleaning, they're going to be turning on and off lights as they go. So go around with those wipes and hit the light switches and all those commonly touched objects like the doorknobs, and try to just get those cleaned, because those are things that are often missed.
So since we're probably flying and staying in a hotel somewhere, we might be going to an amusement park. And boy, does that open up a whole host of things. A lot of them have their own different things that they are trying to get people to do, such as the masks and stuff. But again, now we've got a whole other element. So what might be there that we haven't seen in a while?
So again, when you're waiting in lines, you have those metal railings that people are touching, that kids are putting their mouths on, you know, just essentially the same as being in any public place. So really the best thing to do there would be to try to remember to wash your hands as often as you can, especially before you eat, and to have some hand sanitizer with you to, again, use before and after you get on rides or in those areas where there are a whole bunch of people waiting together.
It just seems as though when we're talking about being safe, especially again in this whole getting to be a post-COVID time, there are some of the other common things that maybe we should remember. And when we do go away, let's say we're going to one of these locations, and now we might be renting a vehicle, and we might have the kids with us. And besides all of the things we thought about with COVID, what are some of the things we may need to think about in that respect?
If you're flying somewhere and renting vehicles, you have to remember car seats. Some car rental places have them available to be rented, but you would need to call ahead of time, make sure they're available, make sure they're not sold out, make sure they're still renting them. They may have changed policies with COVID, so if they let you rent one 2 years ago, it may not be the same. So I would call ahead of time just to make sure that they are available and put a reservation on them, because if not, you're going to have to bring your own. So that's definitely one of the things to think about.
One of the other things, maybe we're flying someplace to go where we have an opportunity to be near water. A lot of common sense has to go into that, correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. With kids especially, you know, in oceans, in lakes, anywhere with any type of current, you have to remember that even if they're only in up to their knees, they can get sucked under, they can get pulled under, they can, you know, a wave can hit them and knock them over. So even if they're not going in far, you really do have to be right there beside them, have, you know, a life vest or floaties on them to keep them safe, even if they seem to be a good swimmer. And just really be diligent about keeping a very close eye on them.
Would that be something that maybe if you are somebody who likes to go to those type of places, now that, again, other things are getting back to doing things like that, maybe thinking about getting the kids, especially over the summer, involved in some kind of swimming lessons?
Absolutely. It's always a great idea. Even if they are good swimmers, it never hurts to put them in the swimming lessons and let them learn other techniques. And a lot of the swimming lessons for kids now, they even teach them how to rescue others, how to lay down on the side of the pool and reach in if one of, you know, their friends or their siblings falls in. It teaches them how to be safe around water, not just in water. And those are wonderful things to know.
And before I have to let you go here, I think probably one of the biggest parts of common sense is when you talk about just knowing, when you're going out of your own element, knowing where everyone is can sometimes be a little bit of a problem because we think we're out of our element, we're on vacation, we can do whatever we want. What are some of the tips you have to keep us all together so that we don't get separated from anyone?
So there's lots of things you can do. You can dress in bright colors. You can have, if you have older children, teenagers, you can have certain meeting spots and meeting times. But really, it is important to establish those things before you go. You know, everyone's excited when they get there. They want to take off and do their own thing. But you really do have to set boundaries and guidelines. We're going to meet here. We're going to meet at these times, no matter what. If you have to get out of line, get out of line. 5 minutes late, we're going to worry. So you have to set these guidelines ahead of time. Make sure everyone's clear before you get there. That way, nothing gets missed. And then if they're little kids, dress them in bright colors. Make sure they understand they always have to either be holding your hand or right next to you. You really do have to go through these things before you get there, just because, like I said, the excitement is, it makes it tough for kids. They just get so excited. They're not thinking. They all want to go in different directions. So it's really good to talk about those things before you get there.
So besides packing all the other things, including the sunscreen and the first aid kits and the extra wipes and everything else, don't forget to pack the common sense.
Correct. Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.